Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Inglés. Nivel C1. Convocatoria Ordinaria 2022. Comprensión de textos orales.
Task 1. You will hear part of a podcast called Happy Place where the host interviews Miriam Margulies about her new book. Choose the best option, A, B or C, according to the recording. The first item is an example. Write the corresponding letters, A, B or C, on the answer sheet, in spaces 1 to 10. You will hear the recording twice.
Now you have 2 minutes to read the task before the audio starts.
Miriam, what an honour to have you on my podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
It's lovely of you to want to have me, so I'm very glad to be with you, and I hope that I'm technically proficient at all this, because nowadays you have to have a degree in engineering before you can open your mouth.
I know. It's outrageous. I've struggled myself over the last year and a half, but we've worked it out and we pushed through and we're still managing to make the podcast, which is, for me, great, because I absolutely love doing it. And I love just every week getting to chat to someone different about life. And the wonderful thing today is, you know, you've written about pretty much your whole life in this brilliant new book, which I've got an early copy of. I was very lucky to get a sneaky copy.
Well, that's more than I've got.
No way.
I haven't. First of all, and I'm only interested in praise, not criticism. What's it like? Did you enjoy reading it, or what was your feeling?
I loved it. Miriam, I loved your book so much. Not only is it funny and beyond exciting to read, it is packed with stories. It's a love letter to your friends. I just thought it was beautiful and I adored it. So I feel very lucky to have had an early copy. It's brilliant. I mean, a lot of people these days write an autobiography way too early and you get, you know, like 30 years of an autobiography. You waited until the age of 80 to look back on your whole life. How was that? Where do you even start with trying to format that and work out the route that you want to take?
Yes, it was not something I ever intended to do, quite honestly. And I think COVID helped, because lockdown meant what is a girl to do? You know, and I was in Tuscany in my farmhouse that I share with my partner Heather and the chap we know, Peter. And there was nothing much else to do. And then I got an offer that I couldn't refuse from the publisher. So I thought, well, let's go, girl. And so gradually I managed to get myself into the frame of mind that I could talk about myself. And so I have. So it's a very odd thing to do to tell the truth about yourself. And I knew that it had to be the truth. So that's why there's a lot of naughtiness in it, really, because I don't know how people are going to react, because it's not something that every grandmother is going to want to read, is it?
Oh, it's so fun. It's the most fun book because of the naughtiness. And I must add, on this podcast, you can be as utterly naughty and sweary, whatever as you like. We have zero rules here, so don't hold back at all. You say at the start of the book that part of this was to try and make sense of life. Do you think that you accomplished that? Do you feel a sense of understanding of your life now you've completed the book?
I know a bit more about myself, I think, than I did. And I like myself. I've come out of it feeling that I am a decent person. Because I know, obviously, that I've offended a lot of people in my life and people think I'm very rude and that sort of thing. But when I think about what I've done and that sort of thing, I feel pleased. I don't feel smug because I know that I'm not complete yet. I've got a way to go still. But it is quite a salutary experience because you face yourself. And I have done that quite genuinely. So I'm relieved I've done it and I don't have to write another book. My lovely editor, Georgina, said, you know, you must write another. I don't want to write another book ever. This is it, girls and boys, but I'm very pleased I've done it.
Now listen again.
Miriam, what an honour to have you on my podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
It's lovely of you to want to have me, so I'm very glad to be with you, and I hope that I'm technically proficient at all this, because nowadays you have to have a degree in engineering before you can open your mouth.
I know. It's outrageous. I've struggled myself over the last year and a half, but we've worked it out and we pushed through and we're still managing to make the podcast, which is, for me, great, because I absolutely love doing it. And I love just every week getting to chat to someone different about life. And the wonderful thing today is, you know, you've written about pretty much your whole life in this brilliant new book, which I've got an early copy of. I was very lucky to get a sneaky copy.
Well, that's more than I've got.
No way.
I haven't. First of all, I'm only interested in praise, not criticism. What's it like? Did you enjoy reading it, or what was your feeling?
I loved it. Miriam, I loved your book so much. Not only is it funny and beyond exciting to read, it is packed with stories. It's a love letter to your friends. I just thought it was beautiful and I adored it. So I feel very lucky to have had an early copy. It's brilliant. I mean, a lot of people these days write an autobiography way too early and you get, you know, like 30 years of an autobiography. You waited until the age of 80 to look back on your whole life. How was that? Where do you even start with trying to format that and work out the route that you want to take?
Yes, it was not something I ever intended to do, quite honestly. And I think COVID helped, because lockdown meant what is a girl to do? You know, and I was in Tuscany in my farmhouse that I share with my partner Heather and a chap we know, Peter, and there was nothing much else to do. And then I got an offer that I couldn't refuse from the publisher. So I thought, well, let's go, girl. And so gradually I managed to get myself into the frame of mind that I could talk about myself. And so I have. So it's a very odd thing to do, to tell the truth about yourself. And I knew that it had to be the truth. So that's why there's a lot of naughtiness in it, really, because I don't know how people are going to react, because it's not something that every grandmother is going to want to read, is it?
Oh, it's so fun. It's the most fun book because of the naughtiness. And I must add, on this podcast, you can be as utterly naughty and sweary, whatever as you like. We have zero rules here, so don't hold back at all. You say at the start of the book that part of this was to try and make sense of life. Do you think that you accomplished that? Do you feel a sense of understanding of your life now you've completed the book?
I know a bit more about myself, I think, than I did. And I like myself. I've come out of it feeling that I am a decent person, because I know, obviously, that I've offended a lot of people in my life, and people think I'm very rude and that sort of thing. But when I think about what I've done and that sort of thing, I feel pleased. I don't feel smug, because I know that I'm not complete yet. I've got a way to go still. But it is quite a salutary experience, because you face yourself, and I have done that quite genuinely. So I'm relieved I've done it, and I don't have to write another book. My lovely editor, Georgina, said, you know, you must write another. I don't want to write another book ever. This is it, girls and boys, but I'm very pleased I've done it.
Task 2. Listen to part of the radio show The Unexplained, where Howard Hughes interviews Michelle Soulaire about Maine, USA, and her liking of mysterious stories. Decide which 8 of the statements below, A to Q, are true, according to the recording. Write the corresponding letters, A to Q, on the answer sheet, in spaces 11 to 18. The first item is an example. You will hear the recording twice.
Now you have 2 minutes to read the task before the audio starts.
right, let's get to Maine now. And Michelle Solier is there. Michelle, thank you for coming back on my show.
I'm delighted to be able to spend some time with you again.
Well, really nice to be able to do this. And I was always guilty that we didn't have enough time to talk last time. So we're going to get into not only the Bigfoot stuff this time, but also some of the mysterious stuff. First of all, though, I said that I thought Maine was a rather beautiful, somewhat remote-looking, certainly, you know, for a British eye, you've got a lot of space there, a lot of trees, and in the wintertime you can be knee-deep in snow before you know it. But it seemed to me to be the kind of place where people depend on each other, as you have to in a hard environment at times, and stories get passed around. Is that just a romantic impression that I've got, or is that the way Maine is?
I think because, I mean, a lot of us probably work on a fairly lonely basis. Like, you know, anybody who's out working the fields or working the boats and, you know, various typical Maine, you know, beyond the regular blue collar work in the urban areas, you spend a lot of time alone. And so when you get together with people, then yeah, it's the tendency is to, you know, share all these little tidbits that you've been saving up on during the time in between. Yeah, so there's a really good storytelling culture in Maine, and there has been for a very long time.
Yeah, and a very warm, friendly place from what I remember. I remember going to, I mean, look, Starbucks, they make good coffee, but it's not a place really where you're going to meet strangers, particularly. I think, you know, it's a place where you go and get your coffee and you maybe sit there and read the paper, or you get the coffee and you take it on the train, whatever you do. But I remember sitting in Starbucks in Portland, and it was a really warm and friendly experience. And I thought, this is not like other places. So yeah, I can understand all of that. How did your interest in stories of strangeness and paranormality and cryptozoology, how did all that begin?
Oh, well, I mean, even as a kid, I was reading books about strange things like the Loch Ness Monster and, you know, ghosts and UFOs. And then as I got older, you know, went to school, had to work a lot, and then things kind of shifted gears for me, and I was able to start reading more for my own pleasure, and I picked up Lauren Coleman's book, Mysterious America, read that, loved it, and started looking around for stuff like that about Maine, and was discovering that there really wasn't much beyond a few collections of ghost stories and stuff like that. Nobody was addressing all the weird, anomalous little bits of Maine history that I knew must exist. And so when I started my Strange Maine blog, it was to kind of start putting some of that stuff on record. And I've been doing that ever since.
It does seem, if you look at it from the UK, and you know, our knowledge of America is probably incomplete, just as your knowledge of the United Kingdom might be somewhat incomplete. I mean, you might be an expert on it, but you know, I doubt that you would know, you know, every nuance and detail. So if you look at it from over here, you get the impression that all of the good stuff happens in places like California and Florida and, you know, New Mexico. You know, those are the kind of states where you get weird stuff. Sasquatch, Bigfoot, all of this. And nobody ever mentions Maine. And it sounds to me like you thought that was all wrong.
Well, I mean, I knew that we had just as many interesting stories, and just nobody had really paid attention to them yet. So, and I feel like wherever you are, I feel like your location undoubtedly has stories like that somewhere hidden away, that if you go looking for them, you'll find them.
Now listen again.
All right, let's get to Maine now. And Michelle Solier is there. Michelle, thank you for coming back on my show.
I'm delighted to be able to spend some time with you again.
Well, really nice to be able to do this. And I was always guilty that we didn't have enough time to talk last time. So we're going to get into not only the Bigfoot stuff this time, but also some of the mysterious stuff. First of all, though, I said that I thought Maine was a rather beautiful, somewhat remote-looking, certainly, you know, for a British eye, you've got a lot of space there, a lot of trees, and in the wintertime you can be knee-deep in snow before you know it. But it seemed to me to be the kind of place where people depend on each other, as you have to in a hard environment at times, and stories get passed around. Is that just a romantic impression that I've got, or is that the way Maine is?
I think because, I mean, a lot of us probably work on a fairly lonely basis, like, you know, anybody who's out working the fields or working the boats, and, you know, various typical Maine, you know, beyond the regular blue collar work in the urban areas, you spend a lot of time alone. And so when you get together with people, then yeah, it's the tendency is to, you know, share all these little tidbits that you've been saving up on during the time in between. Yeah, so there's a really good storytelling culture in Maine, and there has been for a very long time.
Yeah, and a very warm, friendly place from what I remember. I remember going to, I mean, look, Starbucks, they make good coffee, but it's not a place really where you're going to meet strangers, particularly. I think, you know, it's a place where you go and get your coffee and you maybe sit there and read the paper, or you get the coffee and you take it on the train, whatever you do. But I remember sitting in Starbucks in Portland, and it was a really warm and friendly experience. And I thought, this is not like other places. So yeah, I can understand all of that. How did your interest in stories of strangeness and paranormality and cryptozoology, how did all that begin?
Oh, well, I mean, even as a kid, I was reading books about strange things like the Loch Ness Monster and, you know, ghosts and UFOs. And then as I got older, you know, went to school, had to work a lot, and then things kind of shifted gears for me, and I was able to start reading more for my own pleasure, and I picked up Lauren Coleman's book, Mysterious America, read that, loved it, and started looking around for stuff like that about Maine, and was discovering that there really wasn't much beyond a few collections of ghost stories and stuff like that. Nobody was addressing all the weird, anomalous little bits of Maine history that I knew must exist. And so when I started my Strange Maine blog, it was to kind of start putting some of that stuff on record. And that's, I've been doing that ever since.
It does seem, if you look at it from the UK, and you know, our knowledge of America is probably incomplete, just as your knowledge of the United Kingdom might be somewhat incomplete. I mean, you might be an expert on it, but you know, I doubt that you would know, you know, every nuance and detail. So if you look at it from over here, you get the impression that all of the good stuff happens in places like California and Florida and, you know, New Mexico. You know, those are the kind of states where you get weird stuff. Sasquatch, Bigfoot, all of this. And nobody ever mentions Maine. And it sounds to me like you thought that was all wrong.
Well, I mean, I knew that we had just as many interesting stories, and just nobody had really paid attention to them yet. So, and I feel like wherever you are, I feel like your location undoubtedly has stories like that somewhere hidden away, that if you go looking for them, you'll find them.
Task 3. Listen to an interview with Bill Gates. Complete the gaps with one suitable word from the recording. The first item is an example. Write your answers on the answer sheet, in spaces 19 to 26. You will hear the recording twice.
Now you have 2 minutes to read the task before the audio starts.
So how did it feel to make this prediction and then have the world essentially not listen and not prepare?
Well, there's no good feeling that comes on something like this saying, I told you so. If anything kills over 10 million people in the next few decades, it's most likely to be a highly infectious virus rather than a war.
You know, I just think back of, could I have been more persuasive?
But we've actually invested very little in a system to stop an epidemic. We're not ready for the next epidemic.
How did you make such a prescient prediction? How did you know this was going to happen?
Well, there's a number of respiratory viruses, and from time to time, one will come along that's very transmissive and causes some level of fatalities. Respiratory diseases are very scary because you're still walking around on a plane, a bus, when you're infectious. Unlike some other diseases like Ebola, where you're mostly in a hospital bed by the time the viral load infects other people. Well, there's some risks like earthquakes, where we see small earthquakes all the time, or, you know, the history of war or fire or hurricanes. So you don't forget, these pandemics only come along so irregularly that being lulled into a sense of security where it probably won't be a problem in the next few years, why should we put money into that? You don't buy the insurance policy, basically. This one will help us understand it needs to be a priority.
I feel like humans have an issue, though, with fighting the last battle, potentially. So if we focus on pandemics now, and there isn't one, say, for another 100 years, what is the next disaster? What is the one that we're not prepared for?
Well, I'd point out two. One is climate change. Every year, that would be a death toll even greater than we've had in this pandemic. Also related to pandemics is something people don't like to talk about much, which is bioterrorism, that somebody who wants to cause damage could engineer a virus. And so that means the cost, the chance of running into this is more than just the naturally caused epidemics like the current one.
It feels to me like there's something similar about pandemics and, you know, climate change or like asteroid impact, which is that, you know, they're not very tangible, but you could do a little bit I don't know, it seems like humans are not very good at those sorts of problems.
Well, my favorite writer, Václav Smil, you know, wrote about all the potential kinds of disasters, like, you know, the risk of an asteroid, the risk of a, you know, Yellowstone-like eruption. And in fact, he showed that pandemics were significantly the biggest thing, other than a human-caused nuclear war, that we needed to be more prepared for.
Now listen again.
So how did it feel to make this prediction and then have the world essentially not listen and not prepare?
Well, there's no good feeling that comes on something like this saying, I told you so. If anything kills over 10 million people in the next few decades, it's most likely to be a highly infectious virus rather than a war. You know, I just think back of, could I have been more persuasive. We've actually invested very little in a system to stop an epidemic. We're not ready for the next epidemic.
How did you make such a prescient prediction? How did you know this was going to happen?
Well, there's a number of respiratory viruses, and from time to time, one will come along that's very transmissive and causes some level of fatalities. Respiratory diseases are very scary, because you're still walking around on a plane, a bus, when you're infectious. Unlike some other diseases like Ebola, where you're mostly in a hospital bed by the time the viral load infects other people. Well, there's some risks like earthquakes, where we see small earthquakes all the time, or, you know, the history of war or fire or hurricanes. So you don't forget, these pandemics only come along so irregularly that being lulled into a sense of security where it probably won't be a problem in the next few years, why should we put money into that? You don't buy the insurance policy, basically. This one will help us understand it needs to be a priority.
I feel like humans have an issue, though, with fighting the last battle, potentially. So if we focus on pandemics now, and there isn't one, say, for another 100 years, what is the next disaster? What is the one that we're not prepared for?
Well, I'd point out two. One is climate change. Every year, that would be a death toll even greater than we've had in this pandemic. Also, related to pandemics is something people don't like to talk about much, which is bioterrorism, that somebody who wants to cause damage could engineer a virus. And so that means the cost, the chance of running into this is more than just the naturally caused epidemics like the current one.
It feels to me like there's something similar about pandemics and, you know, climate change or like asteroid impact, which is that, you know, they're not very tangible, but you could do a little bit. I don't know. It seems like humans are not very good at those sorts of problems.
Well, my favorite writer, Václav Smil, you know, wrote about all the potential kinds of disasters, like, you know, the risk of an asteroid, the risk of a, you know, Yellowstone-like eruption. And in fact, he showed that pandemics were significantly the biggest thing other than a human-caused nuclear war that we needed to be more prepared for.
Fin de la prueba.